Hey guys, it's James Chester here. You're listening to the Gather Round the Lamp podcast by underagaslitlamp.com.
Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast.
And instead it goes to Bailey!
Welcome back, villains, and gather round for this week's episode of Gather Round the Lamp, an Aston Villa podcast by underagaslitlamp.com. I'm your host, Andy, and after a busy festive period, I sent the squad for some rest and relaxation and warm weather training during this winter break. And joining me today, back and suitably refreshed, I hope, it's Craig and Dan.
There was definitely a wrong turn with my warm weather training because we've got 4 foot of snow here. But the cold weather training is going very well. And I can tell you that I've been able to consume my own body weight in chocolate over the last several days.
I was going to say, I missed the invite for the warm weather training, or Andy's pocketed the airfare for himself and put it to one side. But it's good to be back, yeah, shivering away.
I would have fancied a few days in Dubai, which I think is where some of the Villa players have been.
Just you running laps, Andy, in Dubai. That's all it's been while Craig and I are shivering away, just you running laps around somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. I wish, God, the last time I ran a lap of anything was a long time ago. But yeah, as I say, it feels like it's been a while since we played. We've had a blank weekend. The last game was Everton away. Which was a goalless draw. Emery's first goalless draw, I think, in English football, in fact. I'm not sure, well, we won't go over the game in too much detail, but what were your thoughts on this one, Craig? Still sort of stuttering a little bit, the team?
I think they did actually okay. I went back and refreshed my memory of this game and took a look at the highlights, and it wasn't actually too bad. I think we played relatively well. We certainly had some opportunities to win the game, and we were all right. I think that we missed a couple of chances by a whisker. We had another goal ruled out for a very marginal offside call. So I don't think it was disastrous. And with Everton kind of fighting for their lives, it's not the end of the world. But now it kind of depends, you know, the benefit of that result will become clear in the fullness of time. If we're able to go and roll over Newcastle and pick up another couple of wins, it will look good. If we do not, then it will look bad, I guess.
I haven't gone and refreshed my memory about this game. I've done the opposite. I've scrubbed it from my consciousness. I don't particularly want to relive it, but we got diced, didn't we? We went there and we got diced. They made it nasty. They made it a bitty game. They made it hard work for us. But we came away with a point. I think Villa of seasons gone by would have probably lost that game to a scrappy goal. So I think it's a point picked up, but yeah, I'd rather move on. It wasn't a particularly enjoyable weekend for anyone, I don't think.
No, I think that was kind of the saving grace, really, that no one has had a particularly good time, probably other than, well, Arsenal and Liverpool both picked up big wins at the weekend. But it's all still quite tight, isn't it, at the top of the league? Obviously, we're fourth now after Arsenal's win against Crystal Palace. But, I mean, my main takeaway from this game, I think, was, I mean, obviously the disallowed goal, which I still can't quite work out what it was disallowed for. They say offside. I can't see it myself. But also, I think Emi Martinez has saved us on this occasion with an excellent couple of saves, particularly I think the one from Calvert-Lewin when he was clean through, and just watching the replay from kind of the goal behind the goal opposite Emi Martinez, seeing him tearing back into his penalty area as Calvert-Lewin goes through was quite amusing, just to kind of get himself in the right position. he about turned and ran back towards his own goal. It was like something off FIFA back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, when you errantly press the wrong button and your goalkeeper comes and does something erratic. But we are not dealing with erraticism here, if that is a word. We are dealing with genius. It is the genius of the world's greatest goalkeeper, and not a year removed from his heroic one-on-one dashing save in the World Cup final, no less. He has repeated the feat in a slightly less fantastical fixture. But even so, away at Goodison on a January afternoon is an important fixture also, and he's saved our bacon. I think the most interesting thing about it was the symmetry with the Calvert-Lewin goal versus Robin Olsen that he scored against us in the League Cup, where dear Robin didn't manage to save a one-on-one. Not that he should have, obviously. The advantage does go with the attacker in that instance, but it just shows the difference there in one clear tableau between having the best goalkeeper in the world in the sticks and Robin Olsen.
Yeah, it turns out Emi Martinez and Robin Olsen are not like-for-like replacements. You can't just take one out. But I don't know if you saw it, and I can't remember what it was. It was one of the FIFA awards last week, and they had the Team of the Year go up. And I think Thibaut Courtois got Goalkeeper of the Year in whatever the FIFA 11 was. And I don't know what Emi Martinez needs to do. Wins the World Cup, is consistently brilliant, and yet still doesn't get named in FIFA's Team of the Year. But he's brilliant, and it's a few times this year he's either saved us points or won us points, and he's worth his weight in gold.
Yeah, I've said a couple of times actually that I think him winning all these awards has always felt like a little bit of a strange concept to people outside of Aston Villa. Obviously, Villa fans love him. We totally understand his value to the team, and the fact that he won the World Cup has kind of elevated him into these conversations, you know, best goalkeeper in the world and winning the Yashin Trophy and all that sort of thing. And everyone else has kind of looked and gone, well, but he isn't the best goalkeeper in the world, is he? And now I just think we are seeing the performances that put him up there. He was always kind of perhaps behind Edison, behind Alisson in the Premier League. But I think he's having better seasons than both of them. And I don't look around and see a goalkeeper who's having a better season currently than Emi Martinez, maybe even in Europe.
Well, the interesting thing is that this character of Tottenham Hotspur, Vicario, has been featured heavily in lots of the half team of the season awards, which to me is bemusing, baffling, confusing even. And I know there is a bias towards certain clubs, but I don't know how anyone could rationally look at Emi Martinez, and particularly Emi Martinez, who's just won the World Cup. It's almost as though he goes under the radar, even though he is the world champion, even though he is clearly one of the best. And he's also not like some shrinking violet. I mean, he's quite the character. He literally did a phallic gesture with the Golden Glove trophy at one of the dignitaries of the Qatari World Cup. This isn't someone who you could think that you would be able to forget or would slip your mind. I mean, this isn't old Tom Heaton, who, you know, could be mistaken for a lumberjack in the mountains chopping wood with a hot cocoa and a cigar. This is Emi Martinez. This is mate of Lionel Messi. And it's peculiar to me. I don't know how you guys characterize it.
Is he maybe a victim of the way Villa play, just to kind of try? I don't think there is an excuse for it, by the way. But you like, Alisson is a busy goalkeeper, isn't he? Liverpool seem to give up a fair number of chances, and Spurs do as well. So the keeper has to make more saves. And because of the way Villa defend, I feel like Martinez is almost in that Edison category, where he's quiet for about 85 minutes of the match and then just has to come to life in one or two moments, which I think it's arguably a harder thing to do as a goalkeeper, to watch the match go by with your hands in your pockets for 80 minutes and then have to suddenly be on it is 10 times harder. But I think if you're the average fan or you're the press or whatever, you gravitate towards the busy goalkeeper, don't you? Because they're doing it that much more per game. But I mean, it's probably a good position to be in if you're Emi Martinez, because you get to you get to have a relaxed afternoon on a Saturday at 3 p.m. You get to chill, to mentally do your shop that week, and then occasionally come to lunch.
I think it's also symptomatic of the fact he's playing for Aston Villa, and even though we are within points of the top of the league and we've been second, we've been joint top, we're not actually considered as realistic challengers, are we? And you know, it's almost like it's like with Ivan Toney coming back this week, and suddenly now he's the backup to Harry Kane because he scored on his comeback. Ollie Watkins is completely forgotten, despite, you know, the incredible 2023 that he had. Ivan Toney's back, so and he's playing for Brentford, and they're in the middle of the league. You know, it just feels like as Aston Villa, we're kind of invisible, and our players have to go way over and above to get any kind of credit, unless of course one of the big teams want them, and then they're the best thing since sliced bread.
It's bewildering, and the Ivan Toney thing has been a little bit strange as well. The almost hero worship of this gentleman who's been banned, let's not forget, for betting on his own football team whilst he was in the squad. I mean, these are very serious charges, and there's not too many footballers who have been banned for 8 months. The last one that springs to mind would be Rio Ferdinand for coincidentally missing a series of drug tests some years ago. Now, these kind of bans are not handed out willy-nilly. So the idea that you would do something as egregious as betting on your own team, and I accept that there is a mitigation that perhaps Ivan Toney there's been suggestions that he suffered from a gambling addiction and maybe he didn't have full control over his actions. But even so, it's a serious breach of the rules. And the idea that you would come back and be lauded in this way is a little bit interesting. You think it would be a little bit more tempered, some of the reactions, but no, he's now a conquering hero.
Well, football has like a narrative problem, doesn't it? Is it we're caught up, kind of the media is, and us as consumers of it and as fans of football, is you're always chasing that next story, you're always interested in that next story. And Villa were only the story for a very small period of time when we had that big week against Arsenal and City. That was our window, that's when everyone was talking about us. And then because we're all of a sudden just a quietly efficient club that plays football well and it's almost machine-like in the way we win, we're not really a story much of the time. There's not much narrative there. So I think it actually suits us in the long run. I'm just saying that it galls me that we don't get many people talking about us. But I think the fact that people aren't talking about us is probably a good thing, because the more we can slip under the radar, the better. And yeah, the Ivan Toney thing is strange, especially as he's getting the praise for cheating and moving the ball a foot away from where it was. Again, goalkeeper should have fixed that. That's fair play to him. But it's hardly a stroke of genius, is it, to pick a ball up and move it a foot to the right? I mean, that's not the answer to England's backup striker problem.
Yeah. I was on a similar sort of thing. I was listening to the commentators on TNT Sports over here, and also Match of the Day on the BBC, absolutely lauding Arsenal for having a set piece coach, and they scored a couple of headers from corners. And you think, where, you know, they're so far behind surely everyone's got a set piece coach, not just Arsenal.
I know that several teams do and several teams don't, and I think it's interesting. I don't know. Is this to Aston Villa's benefit, though, almost, that we are not subject to the glare, other than that kind of box office week, as you say, when we welcomed Arsenal and Man City to town? Is it actually perhaps to Aston Villa's benefit that we don't get the kind of love in that way? It also means we don't get the hysteria when we have a bad result. Like, you do see with Tottenham when they lost a couple of games, it was a major crisis. Arsenal were in crisis until they just won 5-0 the weekend. Man United have been in crisis for 5 years. And that might also take a toll. So perhaps there is something to be said for being a little bit in the background and just being able to get along with your work diligently.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to draw too many parallels between us and Ranieri's Leicester, but it was the same with Ranieri's Leicester. No one was talking about them right the way up until the point they basically won the title. And I think it's a good place to be in as a team, is almost the dark horse, the underdog, because there's nothing worse than being in the limelight and having everyone talking about you, everyone gunning for you. And I suspect Emery would quite like the club to quietly go about its business and be the team that no one talks about, because I think he'd much prefer it that way.
Yeah, I think that's true, and you know, it's just those things you notice, isn't it, about the difference in how teams are talked about. But you know, the teams at the top as well, I suppose, have been in that position for years and decades, haven't they? And now it's you know, we're just you know, just creeping into that conversation this season. So, you know, it makes sense, really, and it would be a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction maybe to be too over the top with Aston Villa. But I did want to just do a little bit of a sort of half-season mini review in this podcast, because we're not really reviewing any games. And one of my questions was around sort of thinking back to the start of the season. And you, Craig, if you cast your mind back to when you're watching Aston Villa in your hometown over there in the summer, and what your sort of expectations at that time were, sort of where you thought we'd be and how that matches up to reality of kind of being, you know, fourth in the league on, was it 43 points, you know, and through comfortably in the Europa Conference League as well. How does that match up with what you thought?
Well, I was certainly not completely clear-headed during that Aston Villa Newcastle fixture in at the Eagles Stadium, it's fair to say, on that balmy July afternoon. But what I do remember from that day was we'd recently beaten Newcastle 4-0 in the league at home, or 3-0 at home, just a few weeks prior. And then it was Villa Newcastle. It was a 3-3 game, but it was much closer than the previous league in Canada had been. And so the things that stood out for me were we had an entirely new shape. Diaby didn't play that day. He'd just signed, and he was kind of on the bench and waving to the fans and stuff. But two players who did play was, ironically, Jadon Philogene, who was one of the star players. And our man of the match that day was actually little Emi Buendia, who scored two goals. Ran Tony Ali, or whatever his name is, another suspended friend, and generally ran the show. Buendia looked to be the player that we all hoped he was going to be coming, and I was really anticipating a big year for Buendia. And obviously, fast forward then a few weeks, and everything changed. We lose Mings, we lose Buendia, we absolutely smash 5-1 by Newcastle, and you're beginning to have some concerns. But I think, based on where we were, I thought at that point in pre-season that a sixth or seventh place finish would be a good season. So to consider where we are now, I think that we are punching well above what I expected. We're doing fantastically well, I would say.
It's a good point, actually, Craig. So kind of my hope at the start of the season, my hope was we'd finish in the Europa League and go one better than the conference. My dream was that we'd maybe sneak fifth and the coefficient would let us get into the Champions League. And that was before we had the injuries. And then we had the injuries. And I think my hope was we might finish seventh again and have a good cup run. So to be where we are in the context of the season we've had, and not just the injuries, but we say it all the time, the disruption at left back, the disruption with JJ, all of those things, I think we're having... It's incredible. Like, I'm still going to pinch myself occasionally just to remember where we're at. And I'm not used to it yet. And I'm still not sure if we'll stay where we're at. But it's been a wonderful ride so far.
Yeah, it definitely has. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I can remember, I often sort of bring this up, but back in March sometime, I kind of made a prediction that we'd be in the top five by Christmas. And of course, we were, and we were actually probably, well, we almost went top, didn't we, for Christmas, if we'd have just beaten Sheffield United that day, robbed by VAR again. I don't know whether I actually believed that or not, or whether I was just saying that because we were on an amazing run at the time, and I'm not entirely sure really what I thought. And I can remember at the start of the season, as you say, Craig, you know, losing 5-1 to Newcastle and the injuries and things, you know, you are tempering your expectations somewhat. But since then, the run's been absolutely incredible, and it's the evolution of the game as well, the style of play. Obviously, last season, the run that we went on, the 10-game run, was very much based on the back four, wasn't it? With Mings and Konsa and Ashley Young mainly, and Moreno and Luca Dean sort of switching at left back. And it was very stable, very solid. And we conceded about two, maybe three goals in that period. And it was, you know, we were, you know, scraping through games 1 or 2-0, but not conceding goals. And this year it's been very much more, there has been a more flamboyant style of play, particularly at home. And that you can see that the game has evolved, their style of play has evolved. It leaves us a little bit more open at the back, and perhaps Mings not being there has done that. But Pau Torres coming in has kind of opened up a world of options attacking wise and going forward, hasn't it? And, you know, it's really, you know, just fantastic to see that development in the team and what Emery's game plan is, particularly at home.
I think that it was one of those, I forget who coined the phrase, but someone said when we signed Pau Torres that Pau Torres has not been signed to improve Aston Villa's defence. And that was kind of a little bit oxymoronic in its meaning. And the fact is that that's exactly what came to be. I don't think we're as defensively solid. We do miss Mings's defensive capabilities. I think we miss his speed, his recovery pace. We certainly miss his physical presence. I think we miss his leadership. But what we've gained through Pau Torres is immeasurable. We're far much more of a penetrative team. We're far more dangerous. We're scoring tons more goals than we were this time last season. And we always look like scoring, even if we don't, as I alluded to in the Everton game. And so Pau Torres has kind of been transformational to a point that it was difficult to really imagine. I think that when we were kind of piecing it together and Pau Torres in pre-season, going back to that, was kind of popping up at left back in a couple of the games. And it was all a little bit confusing as to, well, we've got Mings, who's kind of the leader here. Surely we're not dropping Mings. And then, well, but we've just signed this very expensive centre-half, and I'm not sure we knew quite how it was going to fit. And now we see, with unfortunately for Aston Villa and Tyrone Mings, with him being removed from the equation, the Pau Torres Express is fully underway, and it's difficult to see how we live without him, because it's been a real struggle, I think, in the last few weeks, as well as Longley's done. Longley is still not Pau Torres. Pau Torres has now become really fundamental to the way we play, and made himself in a very short period of time an absolutely indispensable piece of the Aston Villa jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, like the goals have dried up too, haven't they, the last few weeks, which you don't normally say when a centre-back's out injured. You don't normally think, oh yeah, the goals will dry up at the other end. But that's kind of, whether it's coincidence or whether it's actually a tactical thing, it's really interesting. And I like what Andy, what you said about evolution, because I think, kind of going back to your point about expectations versus reality, Villa have been streaky before. We went on that run under Dean Smith, as you say, we had that run under Unai Emery. But the real joy this year is everything feels sustainable. This feels like this isn't flash in the pan success. This is where we're going to be from now on. We're finally operating as a team should, a top team should. And yeah, there's kinks to get out, but this feels like now what business as usual is going to be for Aston Villa. If it's not this year, then I reckon next year we'll have a crack at the Champions League. And it's just going to be regular business for us now on. And I think that's been the joyous thing. Wherever we finish this year, that evolution in the way we play and the fact we've we've started to walk around the league with the swagger that the top team has, I think, has been really joyous.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's been, you know, a totally different experience watching Aston Villa, hasn't it, this season as well? And I think for a long, long time, there was always that feeling, certainly under Steve Bruce, certainly under Dean Smith, where if we conceded first, we would lose, you know. And now we're seeing a Villa team that is going sort of deep into games and snatching points in injury time late in games and as well. And that's a totally different experience to what we're used to. Or quite often you concede the first goal and your head drops, doesn't it, as a Villa fan. It's kind of, oh, that's it then, another Saturday wasted, you know. It's kind of, but it isn't like that, particularly at home. I mean, one of my moments of the season, I'll ask you for yours in a bit, but one of my moments of the season was that Crystal Palace game, because, you know, we were gone. I mean, we conceded the goal and we looked sort of devoid of anything, really. And then Duran scores that absolute wonder strike on 88 minutes, and we end up winning 3-1. I mean, it was an astonishing sort of last few minutes of the game. And, it, you know, you sort of look back at the game, you think, how did that happen? But this is what we have now, I think, with this team under this manager. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, and also what are your sort of moments of the season so far?
I would say, in response to that there is a newfound belief, and we're just so much better now. And when you say the word Steve Bruce, a cold chill went straight down the center of my spine, and I was reminded that we are kind of in the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan, and all that good stuff. It's absolutely incredible where we've come from in such a short space of time, and to go to go so quickly from Steve Bruce, I shouldn't laugh, he's a real human, and to go from Steve Bruce to Unai Emery in such a short period of time, obviously with a cup of coffee with old Stevie G, has been quite the ride. In terms of moments of the season, there's a couple. I think an honorary mention goes to that very first European fixture against Hibs. Just to see Aston Villa back in Europe again after over a decade was quite special. Yes, we know it's the third tier of European competition, but European competition it is. And when Villa kicked off that preliminary eliminator, or whatever you call it, back in the summer against Hibs, you know, that was quite a moment in terms of just the journey we've been on. But for me, the moment of the season is the win against Man City. It literally moved me to tears. And it was just a really special thing. I've never felt so proud, oddly enough, of an Aston Villa side. We've had the relief of kind of staying up on the last day against West Ham. When we won the playoff final, my overriding feeling was kind of relief as well as joy. But this was just pride. It was like, I don't know, watching your kid take its first steps, or, you know, watching your pint come over from after you've had a hard day at the office. You know, whatever. It was good.
The Man City one is, I hate to be boring, the Man City one is the moment for me too. I was kind of, I'm almost, Andy, for your reason about, we've been conditioned as Villa fans. We're a bit like Pavlov's dog, aren't we? We've had, you know, we've been told enough time that we're rubbish, and we've seen that we've been rubbish enough times that your natural reaction is to go, we're rubbish, isn't it? And that game in particular, I've been out just for a couple of drinks after work with a friend, and I was half rushing home for the game, but half thinking, there's no point rushing home. We're just going to get turned over by City here. And then to watch it all unfold in front of me was like, you know, like a choose your own adventure book. And we'd chosen a completely different path. And it just felt amazing for that reason. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It felt like a real turning point for this club. An honourable mention should probably go as well to the Luton game. So I got to come down, hang out with you and James for the game beforehand, which is always good fun. And again, rather than the normal where we spend the pre-match build-up worrying, are we going to lose here? Is it going to be a bad day for us? just felt entirely confident that we were going to go into that game and have a good time, which is a rarity on my trips down to Birmingham.
Yeah, that was before Luton found their feet, wasn't it? So it felt like a bit of a gimme, that one. I mean, I guess the Man City, if you twisted my arm, the Man City game would be my highlight as well. But, you know, I was just thinking actually about, Craig, when you said about, you know, feeling quite moved by that performance. I think there's been three games where I've kind of felt a bit like that during that year. And you mentioned the Newcastle game at home, the 3-0 win, which was just a demolition of Newcastle, who were certainly one of the informed teams in the league last season. And we just took them apart over 90 minutes. And then, of course, the Brighton 6-1, you know, just because we haven't had many of those games where we've just absolutely taken a team to the cleaners on the score sheet as well, you know, and absolutely deserved victory again of another really good side. And then topped off with the Man City win. Those three games were like times where I've looked around and thought, we are actually back here, we are actually worthy of this position in the league. And all, you know, incredible days at Villa Park, you know, which, you know, we have had some good days, even though, like, people talk about how bad the previous 10 years were and all this sort of thing. We had some good times, and even under your mate Brucey, you know.
You said it again.
Craig just shuddered on the screen.
He started the process of turning it round. Before that, you know, we were an absolute joke outfit, and he brought in players like Terry and Hourihane and Chester, who created a professional environment in the dressing room again. And, you know, okay, you know, it went the way things do with Steve Bruce in the end, but, you know, he started that, in my opinion. I enjoyed that season under Brucey.
How have we ended up on enjoying Steve Bruce's work on a review of the current season?
No, I know. I just had to get that in.
I would say, and not to go down a rabbit hole here, I think that some of the work that Steve Bruce did is overstated. I think that Di Matteo was chronically unlucky during his run. And I don't think Di Matteo is actually a better manager than Steve Bruce, so let me say that. I do think Steve Bruce was a better fit for what we needed. But I think Di Matteo was chronically unlucky with some really, like, poor, like, bad, like, mistakes. And I think he would have been okay. And I think we only finished, like, 13th in that first season. I also think that Bruce's kamikaze approach to squad building is one of the things that sent us to the wall, really. And he has form for this. He did a similar thing at Hull. He did a similar thing at Wigan. And he really, he spent the crown jewels on getting us up, and he failed to do it. So I find him annoying, because I hold him culpable for us being where we were selling car parks to pay a tax bill, alongside, obviously, Wyness and Zia and the rest of them. So I find it very difficult to get past that. And that might make me petty, but I just find it difficult to forgive that from Steve Bruce, because he should have known better.
I mean, talking about sending shivers down people's spines, Di Matteo in charge of Villa and finishing 13th in the Championship. We're fourth in the Premier League. How were we ever 13th in the Championship? No matter what Steve Bruce did, and it's horrible to think at a time when we had one fit centre-back and poor Chester was having to run through his own kneecaps to play for us, but Steve Bruce is the best crime author to manage Aston Villa, and I feel like we should reserve a faint bit of praise for that, just because Emery has done a lot for Villa, but he's never written a three-part murder mystery, so I feel like that, until he's achieved that level, we can't really put him in the same conversation.
We don't know that. Emery might be writing under an alias right now, for all we know.
I mean, the difference between a Steve Bruce crime novel and an Emery crime novel, it'd be like Mr. Men versus Dostoevsky, wouldn't it? The difference would be unbelievable. So let's hope Unai Emery does. When he's finished with Villa, maybe he's got a writing career in there.
Yeah, I think his would be way too long and detailed. it would go on for years, wouldn't it? It would just be, too much. Like keep him on the training ground with Aston Villa for as long as possible. I say, and we'll benefit from some of those brain cells. We've gone off topic slightly. I just wondered, obviously sort of had the moment of the season there. What about player of the season? Who's your standout performer for this season so far, Craig?
Probably Douglas Luiz, who would just edge out John McGinn, I think, for me.
Yeah.
But it's close.
McGinn for me, I think he was good when Emery first came in, but he's been another level this year. He's been a proper captain this year, I feel like, too. I was critical of McGinn being given the armband, but he's just been everything we wanted him to be this year, and hats off to him. Played just about every position on the park as well, which is always good to see.
Yeah. He's I mean, they've both been absolutely integral, haven't they, to everything we've done. But I mean, you mentioned Pau Torres as well. I mean, we've talked about him, but he really has changed the way the team play, hasn't he? And both in more so in an attacking sense, as we say. I think he was a player that I sort of really wanted in the summer, and I was really pleased when we did get him. He's kind of gone above my expectations, even, I think. As much as I miss Tyro Mings, I'm absolutely loving watching Pau Torres play every week.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and I do still miss Mings, and I think we all know what Mings means to us on this show. We've been very clear, but Pau Torres has been a real breath of fresh air, a real different type of centre half than we've had. And I think that also Konsa has been incredible, played so many minutes, deputising at right back when Matty Cash has been either unfit or unfancied, and is doing really, really well. Obviously, first international call-up for Ezio Konsa as well. Southgate didn't decide to give him even a single minute, despite playing everybody else in the whole other squad over the recent internationals. But that is Southgate's going to Southgate. No point being annoyed at a rock for being a rock. You just get yourself wound up, and it's important to also mark his journey as well, Ezri Konsa, as someone who is really emerging. And I think I don't know if you guys saw, there was some recent Unai Emery quotes about Konsa where he said something to the effect of, Ezri Konsa still doesn't know how good he is, and he isn't nearly at his potential yet, which I thought was interesting because he's playing out of his skin. Yeah.
Scary to think about him getting better. While we're on the defender, loving a little hat tip for Carlos as well, who I thought he'd struggle to get even back to kind of Premier League level. Yeah, he's played some important minutes for us, and it's been good to see him actually on the pitch for Villa.
Yeah, I think, I mean, on Ezri Konsa, he has been incredible. It's almost one of the disappointments, though, to see him playing at right back. He's good at right back. But I thought he was absolutely coasting, cruising through at centre-back earlier in the season alongside Torres. And we've had to split that partnership up, almost deliberately to play Konsa there at right-back. And I don't know, it just feels like we need something there. We need a solution to that so Konsa can play in his more natural position. I'm always a little bit, he's good at right back. He's fantastic, but I'm always a little bit disappointed to see him at right back on the team sheet when he's there.
Well, we may have a solution for this coming through.
What a segue! What a segue that is.
Old Costa Nedeljkovic.
Yes.
Yep. Yep. That was good, Lister. Yeah. I'm happy with that. Good.
Sounds right to me.
Sounds right to I'm me. Glad you, Andy, how would you say it, Andy?
Costa Nedeljkovic.
Good. Yeah. That's
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Daniel, do you want to have a
the young right back from Red Star is how I'm pronouncing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, he'll be hopefully coming in the summer, won't he? It's rumoured, it's not confirmed yet as we record today, but 18-year-old right back from Red Star Belgrade, Serbian. Fullback is apparently set to sign for Aston Villa and return to Red Star Belgrade for the rest of the season. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he's obviously been scouted, highly rated youngster. Obviously, a lot of developing still to do at that age, you would imagine, but has been playing for their first team. So, you know, hopefully he'll come in and do the business. Who was the last right back to sign in January and go back to his club on loan before coming in the summer?
Well, Andy's favourite right back, Freddie Gilbert. Old Freddie is, I think, not having a good time of it. So I hear. Although his fellow countryman Morgan Sanson, speaking of transfers, apparently is set to secure us a £4 million bonanza that we never thought we would get. Apparently, Monchi has worked some stardust into his loan deal, Morgan Sanson, that is, and if he plays two more games and Nice, I believe it is, finish in the top eight, they're currently second, we get £4 million and Morgan will be gone permanently. And I know that you will miss Morgan, Andy, as much as you've missed Freddie Gilbert.
Yeah, two really, really poor signings. Really bad signings.
I feel like we're tarring our poor young right back with a bad brush here by even bringing up Freddie Gilbert's name. Like, the lad's playing in the Champions League already. Freddie Gilbert's going to get nowhere near the Champions League in his career. He's, you know, but yeah, it would be nice to get a nice, yeah, little pun there to get a bonus out of Morgan Sanson still.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, that, you know, he was just one of those players. It just felt like it was never going to work. He kept being injured. He kept going away. He kept coming back, and he just wasn't. He wasn't producing the goods. And you know, all three managers that he played under said what a talented player he was, and none of them could bear to pick him. So it, you know, it was a tricky one. So if we got £4 million back for him, then that'll be quite tidy, quite pleased with that. I didn't know that, Craig. So
hey, yeah, well, for, I am
cheering me up.
Well, he signed 3 years ago in January 26, 2021 for a reported £14 million. So on a 4.5-year deal, so we're 3 years in, so that £14 million, so if we book a £4 million fee for him, that is, I think, going to be break even there or thereabouts, to quote Steve Bruce, on on the FFP chart. So that will, and also his wages will be gone, so that kind of is a little bit of a Brucey bonus there. Hey?
Lovely. Hey? Lovely stuff. Maybe this explains why we're looking at young talent all of a sudden, because we're looking, I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the name of the young goalkeeper we've been linked with, and of course Morgan Rogers from Middlesbrough too, is we've seen what happens when we buy Premier League ready, in heavy inverted commas, kind of players to join the squad. Maybe young players is the way to go. You could, for one Morgan Sanson, you can maybe get three hot prospects, and you're spreading your odds of one of them coming good, and spreading the FFP impact on them as well. So maybe that explains, maybe Morgan Sanson explains our change of tack towards young players.
I actually, a couple of things. Morgan Sanson, I did think, was very, very talented. And every time he played, he looked like there was something there, but obviously it just never settled. It never happened. The goalkeeper you're referring to is Hakon Rafn Valdimarsson, is what I'm going
Fantastic.
With. And he will, of course, be the speaking of Steve Bruce signings, the second Iceland, or the first Icelandic player to grace our Aston Villa shirt since Birkir Bjarnason of another one of Steve Bruce's Trolley Dash friends.
Yeah, yeah. Another dreadful guy. But yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, promise so much, you know, the Icelandic, the hair, the beard, you know, the look. He was gonna be a great Aston Villa player, wasn't he? And he just couldn't play football. It was just that simple. It was, you know, but yeah, you know, it's we'll see. But like you mentioned, we are chasing quite vigorously, I believe. Morgan Rogers, who's a winger from Middlesbrough, played against Villa in the third round of the FA Cup as well. Borough are believed to want around 10 million for him, and apparently we've offered around half of that fee up to this point. It's interesting, isn't it? It's an interesting kind of target, really. Not a player I'd really heard of much until we played them the other week. Former Man City youngster, previously at West Brom, grew up in Hal's Owen, so he's relatively local. But I wonder whether the academy, Harrison in the academy, has had a bit of an input into this, because he would have perhaps known him during his time at West Brom. But it's an interesting one. What do you make of this?
Well, there's a couple of things. We've been talking about this in our famous Gather Round the Lamp group chat. And I would say that the first thing is, yes, this is someone who would have been known to Mark Harrison. This is someone who's bounced around a little bit. It seems to be someone who's a prospect, for sure. And he definitely has an interesting skill set that we might be missing, particularly in terms of physical profile. I think he's 6'2 or 6'3". And we do lack size as a team. You know, Villa have a lot of very small players. So having someone of bigger stature who has good technical ability, obviously wonderful grounding in terms of the of the Man City system coming through there, and best mates with Cole Palmer, apparently, who enjoys a penalty. Sure. And it's an interesting link. But this is someone, and I actually listened to a Middlesbrough podcast to hear some Middlesbrough fans talking about it. Also, my brother-in-law is a Middlesbrough fan, so that's something interesting. And the general consensus was that Morgan Rogers, that is, has just not been very good up until the last 4 weeks or so, and has just started to put the pieces together now. So definitely, and the Middlesbrough podcast guys, and I will shout them out in a minute when I find the name of the podcast, they also said that they do not think that this player is good enough to start for Aston Villa. And not only do they think he's good enough to start for Aston Villa, they also think he would struggle to be, you know, one of the first choices off the bench at the moment. Now, obviously, he's only 21, and the idea is, you know, he's going to be there for the future. So I wonder if it would be, if he's not ready now, is this something where he would be signed and then left at Middlesbrough for the rest of the season to develop and then come in the summer? I don't know. I find this curious, given the sales of Ramsey and Jadon Philogene, that we would be targeting someone like this. But I know you guys have other thoughts, so go ahead.
I'm excited, but I don't know tons about him as a player, but I read a fantastic interview with him in The Athletic this week, which is probably purely coincidental, but he comes across as an incredibly mature young man who talks really honestly about why it didn't work for him at Man City and why he's only just putting the pieces together now. And that's the kind of picture I get of him, is he's a player with all the talent in the world who's never been in the right environment, and now he's suddenly in the right environment and we're starting to see what he might become. But I think the bigger issue with this, to not all get all kind of Aston Villa accounting podcast, but this is where FFP is a bit of a farce, because as Craig says, we sold two very good young attacking prospects in Ramsey and Philogene, but it almost makes more sense financially to sell those and then go and buy another prospect who's possibly the same level or the same promise than it does to hold on to your own prospects and kind of give them a chance in your first team. And I think it's going to be a winter of FFP. It's going to be all anyone talks about in the January window, because a lot of clubs are up against it. And I think Villa are going to be a prime example of you sign a Morgan Rodgers for 10 million spread over 5 years. That's 2 million on the books this year compared to the 25 million we got for Ramsey and or whatever we got for Ramsey and Philogene. So it kind of makes no sense. You have to sell your own prospects and go buy maybe not as good or just as good prospects to balance the books. And I think we're in a frustrating position as fans until we see him on the pitch. And this might be a Monchi and Emery masterstroke, and we've got the next Ashley Young, who's probably the last championship player who signed in a January window who went on to achieve great things for us. So, but it's going to be a weird winter of us balancing books with strange deals like this and signing young players on long contracts to spread it out while selling our hottest prospects to other clubs for big money. It's a strange one, but I like the tack. I like us signing young players. It really excites me because it just takes one of them to suddenly realise their potential and you've got a real fan favourite on your hands.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that it doesn't look like we're particularly looking to strengthen the first team this window either, you know. And if we are constrained by FFP, it's obviously a good chance to kind of build the kind of that underlayer of the squad, if you like, or, you know, to kind of those prospects that are coming through. Sometimes you have to sign players when they become available. You know, you can't necessarily choose when you sign a player. You know, if we didn't sign, if Emery and Monchi want this lad and they don't sign him now, he might be off somewhere else. He might have different ideas come the summer. It's sometimes you have to kind of strike while the iron's hot with these things. But obviously they are in a position where they have to be a little bit careful and a little bit more creative with their dealings. So, I mean, I can't comment on him. I know very, very little about him. So I'm not going to comment on whether I think he's going to be a good signing. And I do take the point, you know, it does seem strange when you've got Philogene, you know, playing really well in the Championship with Hull. And even to some degree, Cameron Archer, who has scored a couple of goals in a really poor Sheffield United team in the Premier League. So, you know, it's strange, but I think it's purely down to FFP and balancing the books and keeping us below that line so we don't get points deductions like and charges like Forest and Everton.
I think so. And I've read, it is the You Are My Borough podcast. If anyone's interested in listening to their, they talk about Morgan Rodgers on a recent episode in some detail. And I found that interesting. And then they started previewing Rotherham and I had to turn it off. But anyway, because it gave me PTSD memories from Steve Bruce and the Championship. But anyway, the other thing I would say about Morgan Rodgers is I read... Now, the slightly annoying thing is this is someone who was available for Man City and who Middlesbrough signed for somewhere between £1 and £2 million in the summer. But then, you know, it is also, so he was available in the summer for transfer because he's only just moved. So that's clearly one that we missed in the summer. And again, that could have been a timing thing as well. Perhaps he moved to Middlesbrough before Emi Buendia was injured and before Jadon Philogene kind of more or less demanded to leave, as is the rumour. So I can, you know, you can give that one a pass. And now we are here in January. You would suggest I read somewhere, and I'm not sure it was The Athletic or if it was Miguel Delaney in Independent, but I read somewhere that Unai Emery basically fell in love with him, Morgan Rodgers, that is, when previewing the Middlesbrough FA Cup match and looking through the Middlesbrough videos and just, you know, it was kind of love at first sight, which obviously you can't help, you know. You could be walking through Waitrose and you see someone across the aubergines and you have thoughts about what you like to do with those aubergines and you ask them out for a drink or a cup of coffee and that seems to, maybe that's just what happened. Emery's just spotted this guy in his pre-match endeavors to defeat Middlesbrough, sees him again live in the flesh up at the Riverside Stadium and decides that I just have to have this guy. And maybe it's just as simple as that.
Do we think that's how Emery approached him, sending aubergine emojis via WhatsApp to him? Is that a completely different thing, Craig? I don't really know.
I mean, I wouldn't like to speculate, but I would say that Emery, you know, I think he could be persuasive.
But it's a good sign, right? I mean, if Emery has watched this guy and fallen in love with him, Emery knows a thing or two about football, doesn't he? So that's a good sign. I think the only other thing about Rodgers that we should probably add is it's not comparing apples with apples, is it? He's a number 10 by all accounts, Rodgers, and we do lack a number 10 at Villa. So maybe, you know, the comparisons with Ramsey and Philogene are somewhat unkind because he's more of a behind the striker kind of lad.
Yeah, I think we also have to. We always say this, don't we? Whenever Emery signs a player, we just have to wait and see, because there's a reason why Emery's signing a player. It's a little bit different now with Monchi involved, because Monchi has signed some excellent players and some excellent talent in his career, but he's also signed some absolute, Stumas as well, hasn't he? So we do have to wait and see. But I'm assuming that with most of these, that Emery has the veto on the players, and Monchi's there presumably to just get the deals done. But we'll see if it happens. I imagine Borough are probably waiting to see. They're playing Chelsea in the second leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final, aren't they, on Tuesday? So we may know by the time this podcast comes out, if it's after Tuesday, what's happening. They might be just hanging on to him to try and get to Wembley, and then they'll make a decision on him.
So
we'll wait and see on that one. And talking of the FA Cup or cup competitions, and talking of Chelsea, we are off to Stamford Bridge on Friday night to play the fourth round of the FA Cup. Pochettino's side, of course, are beginning to show a little bit of consistency after a really turbulent first half of the season, an awful season last year. And they obviously, as I say, will be preparing for the probably the EFL Cup final, should they get past Borough on Tuesday night. Emery will be hoping to have Pau Torres and Luca Dean available to add to Youri Tielemans, who came on against Everton. But it sounds like Jacob Ramsey is possibly injured for this one. I mean, he's broken his own cup hoodoo with Villa in the third round, getting through that. And he's also broken the Villa third round hoodoo as well in that game. So it'd be nice to get through the fourth round as well, but it'll be a tough game at Chelsea, of course. How do you expect Villa to approach this one, particularly, of course, with Newcastle coming up soon after on Tuesday night as well?
Well, you mentioned earlier, Andy, the warm weather getaways that some of the lads have been enjoying in Dubai, and I know John Duran rocked up in Colombia and was ambushed by a local journalist. So lots of these players will have had some refreshing breaks. So you'd think we'd go strong. We'd like to see, you know, hopefully Pau Torres is fit. Hopefully Youri Tielemans may be ready to start. And there is enough time then before the game on Tuesday. The fact that this is a Friday night game gives us an extra day before the fixture against Newcastle at Villa Park. So you would hope that, you know, anyone who's carrying little knocks and bumps and bruises has had a good couple of weeks off to heal and get some sunshine and top up that vitamin D and all that good stuff. So I would hope that we'd go strong. This is a competition that we can win. Chelsea also are much closer to winning the Carabao Cup, and we'll be playing, as you say, tomorrow as we record on Tuesday night. So their players may be fatigued from that Middlesbrough game. And you know, hopefully that one goes to extra time, and they really, if they do extra time in the League Cup, I don't know. And I would expect that we go strong. I know Robin Olsen is fit again. No offense, Robin, I don't need to see you in this fixture. And I hope we go strong, and I hope we try and win and progress to the next round of the Cup, where hopefully we could get a kinder draw this time.
No offence, Robin Olsen, but here's a massively offensive statement to you. But no, I kind of agree with Craig. I think the Carabao Cup semi-final really works in our favour, even though Chelsea have got billions of pounds worth of players. They've struggled for a start in 11, and I think that there's not much chemistry between the squad players there. So I think that will go in our favour. And I actually quite fancy us on this one. I quite fancy us to kind of sneak away with a classic Emery away performance result and get something. And as you said, Andy, we finally got some bodies returning to the club. So there's never been a better time for a game. So yeah, quite fancy us in this one.
Yeah, I kind of, as the game gets closer, I kind of fancy us too. I think, and I do think we should absolutely go strong. I think it's important. I think that Tielemans plays and gets a good sort of chunk of the game under his belt. But I think we have to be thinking about winning the game rather than getting players minutes really. And you know, we need to go and you know, carry on our really good run at Stamford Bridge. We've won there the last two seasons, and I think we need to go and put them out the cup and progress, because we need the heat on us as well. I think we need to ramp it up now in the second half of the season and give ourselves loads of great things to play for, and the FA Cup, a run in the FA Cup, or even, you know, getting to the final would just be tremendous. I've kind of changed my view now we've got through the third round. It was either go out in the third round or go and win it, and now we're through, I want to go and win it. So let's see. But yeah, I'd be absolutely picking the first 11 for this one, and you know, having some good options on the bench to rotate, but essentially just going for this one with the knowledge as well that we've got a huge game in the Premier League coming up on Tuesday night as well. But yeah, looking forward to it. Actually, I think it should be a pretty good cup tie. I would have preferred a more interesting game, but you know, I think it'll be a good match. So, any predictions for this one, guys?
Cheeky 1-0 Unai Emery special.
Yeah, I was going to go 1-0 too, or for our listeners currently seeking their life partners in Waitrose, kind of one aubergine to one bagel. Let's put it like that, just to make it different.
Right, I'm going to go for. I think it's going to be an exciting game. I'm going to go 3-2 Villa. I think be a few goals in this one, and we'll nick it with the odd goal. So yeah, hopefully we're in that hat come Monday night, and then of course it'll be on to Newcastle, which we'll perhaps review that after the game. We'll review both games next week at some stage. So yeah, great. Obviously, thanks for joining me today, guys. All we've got time for, but really good to catch up and talk about a few different things, I think, than the usual podcast. It was good fun. Just to point everyone in the direction of the website, there's a new article up by our new writer, James Woodcock, who's put an article up there about Moussa Diaby and his mixed fortunes so far since signing for the club. So that's well worth a read. Excellent article by James. So good to have him on board, and head over to underagaslitlamp.com to check that one out. And of course, give us a follow on all the socials. You know, follow us on X and Instagram and Facebook as well as Threads. Although I think Regan's given up with Threads now, but yeah, give us a follow on there for all the latest news on the shows and any new articles that come out. Looking forward to Friday. If you're going to the game, have a great day. I think there's a load of Villa fans going down on Friday night, so that should be excellent occasion. And of course the Newcastle game next week as well. But until then, till next week, stay safe and up the Villa.